So I will give a bit of an historical perspective of this area, concentrating on the topological perspective, which actually goes back even more 45 years, which I will try to explain how it starts and what is the current situation. But I must start with telling you a little bit about my visit to the Museum of Arts and Crafts, because I really got fascinated by the museum in many ways. It's a very beautiful and interesting place. It has actually a huge collection, out of which 2,500 objects are displayed, since it's in the same place, in the same building actually, since 1802 when the museum opened. And there are many things interesting about the building and the foundation. The building itself actually is from the Middle Ages, from 2060, and was actually given to Hugh of Cluny, also a very fascinating person, from also from the technological point of view. Actually, he's among many things, he's famous because he built the largest structure in Europe that was actually the largest for many centuries. And then afterwards, after the French Revolution, that it changed, then the founder of the museum itself was also a fascinating Catholic priest, Henri Grégoire, which was also an interesting person from the technological perspective. He was also a revolutionary against slavery and many interesting things. And well, the museum has actually a fascinating collection of objects of all sorts, airplanes and cars and so on. And it emphasizes a lot in the brochure and everywhere that what is displaying is, are objects, objects that were at the high point of the industrial upheavals of the last two centuries, this original Foucault pendulum and so on. It's really a nice museum. And of course, I was motivated to go to the museum because it has displays of the first mechanical calculators, this Pasqualina, which has actually several of them and are amazing to see in reality.
What is the address of the museum?
I said tickets outside. But it's really fascinating because when you see this original version, probably all of you have seen these pictures of this this Pasqualina, but it's actually very small when you look at them. Or this beautiful golden machine are really, really nice, and many other historical computers and crypto machines and precisions and textiles fabrications of Jacquard that we have read. It's really a beautiful object. But all of these objects that are, many of them are really about computation. Actually, many other objects are about communication, not about computation. And this, in fact, the objects of computation are kind of spread out over different exhibits of the museum, but the objects of communication, they are all in the same part of the museum, in one single exhibit, this, that is called communication objects. And they have very nice, things related to, of course, to this optical telegraph that was at some point all over Europe communicating with each other. But broadcast for the distributed computing community, it has also some of the first broadcasting machines that actually appeared. This theatrophone machine actually appeared at the same time of the telephones. And it is said that Proust could sit in his room in Paris and have his earphones with two cables, stereophonic, and he was not listening to a recording. Actually, he was listening to live opera that was being transmitted to many places through these tetraphones machines that were popular at the turn of the century. But from the perspective of today, the object is, the museum is full of objects. But what about interaction of objects, which is the topic of the workshop, distributed systems? Actually, all of these computing objects, we know that they are just instances of Turing machines. But and also for many years at the beginning of the history of computer science, we used to think that it's the same thing. One computer, one Turing machine, or many Turing machines are really equivalent. They can both compute the same things in terms of computability, just parallel computers can do them faster. But actually, in the recent years, and the history I want to tell you, is that when you have computers interacting, actually what you have is a system which is very different from a Turing machine. Except for, of course, in an ideal world where everything is perfect and synchronous and failure-free. And actually, what was cute while visiting the museum is that the answer to this question, what do you get when you have interacting objects that do computing by communicating with each other, actually the answer was in another part of the museum that they have a nice, very beautiful exhibit about mathematics, which was also crowded. One of the fascinating things about the museum is that it's full of people of all ages, of all kind, teenagers and people in love go there somehow to pass the day, and it's really an interesting place. And of course, the topology part of this exhibit is very nice. And that is actually the answer, that when you combine interacting computing elements, what you get actually is topological deformations. And the story, perhaps the highlight of the story of the celebration of what happened 25 years ago was the discovery of this Herlihy-Shabit theorem, which actually provides a precise equivalence between interaction and topological deformations, which has a little bit earlier the one-dimensional version of that by Biran, Moran, and Zaks, that they made the same discovery kind of essentially, but it only when at most one process could crash in the system, could fail. And that was just a topological version in one dimension, behaviors actually of graphs. And then even a bit earlier, even a most basic topological discovery was made, which what is the most basic topological property of a space, whether it is connected or disconnected. And that was actually the Fisher, Lynch, and Patterson famous consensus impossibility, was saying that solving consensus is really precisely related to whether a space is connected or disconnected. But let me go even 10 years before those papers to the very origin of distributed computing theory, where already in the early 70s, people were building actually distributed fault tolerance systems. And that's why I say that actually we are about to celebrate the 45th anniversary of the area of this seminar of today. And I think that the first paper is this 1975 SOSP paper, Some Constraints and Trade-offs of the Design of Network Communications, where they were describing issues related to a system being built in Stony Brook. And at the end of, you read this paper, it's a technical description of how the system worked, and then at the very end of the paper, for us today, it's fascinating what is written there, they start describing this story. There is a group of gangsters that somehow got separated into two groups. Some of the men are holed up in a warehouse across town, awaiting for precise instructions from the other group. And they say it's absolutely essential that the two groups act with complete reliance on each other in executing the plan. I'm quoting directly from this paper. And they say, of course they will never get around to putting the plan into action by communicating, by sending messages to each other, these groups, because simultaneity cannot be achieved by these means. And not, they go even further and they say what we all know today is not also that the sequence of infinite, none of the messages are actually lost. Even they cannot synchronize with each other, even when none of the communication is at fault. So, of course, we know now this is the Byzantine general problems, which actually took a couple of years to formalize it precisely, to be able to say what is this problem of gangsters. That's what Lamport, Pease, and Shostak did in their paper. And in fact, they formalized also the idea that defaults could be completely arbitrary. Before that, people would consider very specific type of faults, whether a bit is stuck to zero and is not moving to one and things like that. Actually, people didn't even understand what kind of failures while they were building these systems they could tolerate. It was generally assumed in those days that a three-processor system could tolerate one faulty processor, where the faulty processor could behave in an arbitrary way. And this 72 paper by SIFT, which was perhaps the project that was notable for producing the Byzantine generals problem and its solution, again, quoting directly from the paper, they were saying, what were they doing to build this fault tolerance system? They were simply saying, okay, you need to do this system to be fault tolerant, so you replicate it, you have three copies, and all of the three copies are running the same code for fault tolerance, and then they do voting to see what is the correct solution, which of course cannot be done. The Lamport, Peace and Shostak 78 paper show that when the failures are completely arbitrary, the system actually can defeat any traditional three-process algorithm. And the more general result that was proved already in 78 was that 3n plus 1 processors are needed to tolerate n arbitrary faults. And also in that paper, they already saw that if you could use digital signatures to make sure that a process that is badly behaved doesn't say contradictory things to different things, then you can... it is sufficient to have 2n plus 1 processes to tolerate n failures. So this is actually, I think, the first impossibility result, which is actually of a topological nature, which is what I would like to explain why. So this in general, I mean, what is this problem that I will soon explain why it is, what is going on is really a topological behavior, is simply the problem of coordination, which is all over in distributed system. Whenever you need to ensure that two actions happen or neither of them happens, like in an automatic teller machine that dispenses cash, either the account balance is debited and the cash is given or none of those actions. But anybody that has taken a course on computer networking has seen a result that says that actually TCP, the basic protocol of internet, can guarantee state consistency between endpoints. Is one of the main results is taught in any course on computer networking. And actually, it's also essential to epistemic logic, common knowledge, and generalizations of this result is what provide a base for what are the realistic expectations of the modern distributed systems that we build. Okay. So what I would like to do is to take again this problem of the two gangsters groups trying to coordinate and explain why in the bottom what is happening is just a continuous deformation of an object. And let's see, analyze what is happening via these graphs of you have two agents. One is a black agent, a black process, and a white process, that are trying to solve this coordination problem. The white process doesn't have any preference, and the black process has two preferences about when to meet with the white process. Either it meets at dawn or it meets at noon. The white process doesn't know what the black process wants, and therefore we are going to model the initial configurations of this system by two edges. Each edge represents a possible initial configuration of this system. So we have the edge on the left that represents the configuration that the black process wants to meet at dawn, and you have at the right edge, which represents the configuration where the black process wants to meet at noon. And these two edges share a vertex because the white processor doesn't know what the other wants. So you represent by a graph all the initial possible global configuration of your system of two processes, which is the first graph. Then you analyze what happens after communication. Here I am represented what happened assuming that they send to each other messages, and one round later, say 1 hour later, the two messages are supposed to arrive under normal circumstances. And you can see, without entering into the details, that what happens is that depending, in this case, of course, the black process is the one that will start by sending a message. The white process doesn't have anything to send because the white process has no initial preference. So the black process starts by sending a message to the white, and there are two possibilities. Either the message arrives or not. If the message arrived, the two initial edges are extended at the endpoints by two additional edges, which represent the situation that now the white process has received the message. But what is the problem when you interchange messages like this? The white process has received the message, but the black process doesn't know whether the white has received the message. And that is why the central vertex is still, white still doesn't know what the black vertex wants because it did not receive the message, but at the two extremes, the white process does know. Now the black is the one that belongs to two edges because the black is the one that doesn't know if his own message arrived. And you can repeat this reasoning and see that every additional hour, what you do is you consider all possible configurations of the system after 1 hour has passed. Each configuration, again, is an edge, and each edge has the two vertices labeled with what is the perspective of these two vertices after 1 hour has passed. And you can do by this simple simple analysis to prove a topological invariant. When two agents are communicating with each other under the possibility that a message may not arrive, no number of successfully delivered acknowledgments will be sufficient because the graph of possible states gets longer and longer but remains connected. This is the topological invariant that communication by two agents, what is doing is stretching a line in a longer and longer way but maintaining the topological invariant of connectivity. Why this implies impossibility result? This is the general structure and framework that we use in this area of the connection between topology and distributed computing. You start with the possible initial configurations of your system, in this case just two edges. Then processors exchange information with each other as long as they want until you stop to analyze what are the possible configurations after some number of exchanges. And we get another graph, which is we call the protocol complex, which has many edges now because for each possible interleaving, each possible scenario of which message arrived and which didn't arrive, you have a configuration of the system, which is again an edge with the two endpoints representing the local perspectives on that execution by the agents. And now the goal is to solve some problem. In this case, is either both processes should meet at dawn or both processes should meet at noon. So if there is a solution to this problem, the protocol complex on each one of the vertices should make a decision saying, oh, we should meet at dawn or we should meet at noon. And these decisions, actually, you can see that these decisions are values in the output complex. So you can view this decision as this decision map that is actually mapping in a continuous way. It's a simplicial map that maps the protocol complex into the output complex in a way that respects the problem specification. And then it's easy to see that the reason why this coordination problem is impossible is because the requirement was to map an initial geometric object which is connected into a final geometric object that is disconnected. And you cannot do that with exchange of information that always preserves the initial topology. It's always connected. You cannot map something connected into something disconnected. So this is the main idea of why communication is about deforming a geometric object. Of course, later on in 1993, there was this discovery that this holds in all generality, not only for two processes, but for any number of processes, and then from then on, many other developments, which opened the way to the characterizations of what are the problems that are solvable by a system of processes exchanging information with each other. And now we have extensions to many other models, in particular about the type of failures that could happen in the model, whether the processes can fail by just crashing, or they can behave in an arbitrary behavior with Byzantine, or even failures that are not independent of each other. We also have seen that the same structural situation of topological stretching holds in any other, in any, no matter what is the communication in which the processes are doing, could be message passing, could be shared memory, could be systems that are more synchronous or more or less synchronous, could be also problems about distributed monitoring of another distributed system, robots that are communicating with each other, essentially it's the same situation. So now there are papers and results of a wide variety of situations that are based on the same basic understanding that what is going on underneath is the stretching of a topological object. And as I will explain, even from the formal methods perspective, because as you can see, even the specification of the task is in terms of a geometric object, as I will show now. So the foundation of the field is given by the essential link between distributed computing and topology, summarized as follows. Any distributed computing model fixes the type of failures, the type of communication and timing. Topological properties determine problem solvability. And time complexity also, how much the processes have to interact, because how much they interact is what it determines how fast the initial geometric object is stretched. And how exactly this stretching is done is dependent on the particular type of failures and asynchrony. So the very central result says, if the system, without entering into detail, if the system is completely unreliable, there are many possible failures, the communication is very, very unreliable, then you have the most perfect stretching. The weakest forms of interaction, weight free, for example, that the programs don't include any weight instructions, you are considering simply all possible interleavings of the operations of all the processors. Computing preserves the initial topology of the space of initial configurations perfectly. What you get is a space that is contractible to the initial space. That means these completely unreliable systems don't introduce any holes of any dimensions or intent for those who know. No, the homotopy groups are not changed and everything remains contractible. And the same framework is used also for any decision problem. So that is why the connection to formal methods is also very interesting. So what is it that you start? You start with the problem specification. What is a problem specification is given again on the top by two geometric objects. You have the set of initial configurations that you are interested for your problem. In this case, instead of two agents, black and white, now you have three processes, the black process, the red process, and this blue process. Each initial configuration, now it's not an edge, it's a triangle. And you may have many possible different initial configurations. You put all these triangles for three processes, or many tetrahedrons for four processes, and so on, so you get an n-dimensional simplicial complex if the number of processes is n plus 1. This is the input to your problem that you want to solve. And now you have also a target set of possible output configurations and an input-output relation delta. This is the task specification. So that is why the connection to formal methods is also very interesting, because the specification of a problem for distributed computing is also in terms of two geometric topological objects and a relation between them. Then you run your distributed program, depending how they communicate, what kind of failures can occur, you get a transformation of the initial complex by stretching it and perhaps introducing holes if the system is more fault tolerant. And then you get another geometric object, which has to be mapped back into the output complex. So the whole question of topology of distributed computability is a question about stretching and mapping to topological simplicial complexes. To be a bit more concrete, let's see how it looks, the simplicial complex, initial simplicial complex for three processes when they are solving binary consensus. So what are the set of initial configuration? Are triangles. Each triangle represents a possible way of giving input values to the processes. and blue, red, and orange processes. And in binary consensus, simply each process starts with a binary input value. So you can see that what you have is that the set, the space of possible input configurations, looks like a triangulated sphere. It has one triangle where all processes start with zero, all three processes start with zero, another triangle on the back where they all three start with one, and then you close this sphere by putting all the triangles that are combining zeros and ones. You can think of this topologically as nothing more than a two-dimensional sphere. And this is the input complex to the binary consensus problem. And now you run some protocol where the processes communicate with each other. In the most general way, you simply consider all interleavings of the instructions of the programs of the three processes. And what can be shown is that actually you remain with a sphere, just the sphere. You are stretching the sphere more and more. How do you stretch it? By subdividing more and more. More and more communication. The more and more they communicate, the three processes, the more and more possible configuration states of your program, and the finer the initial sphere will get. But always you get a topological invariant. No matter what your program is doing, no matter what they are telling to each other, in this very general model, the topology of the input complex is always preserved. But what happens if the model is more reliable? Maybe there are less interleavings, maybe there are less possible failures. Then how does the topology is modified? Then what happens? Let's see an example of the pictures. How does it look? A synchronous model, where the processes are running in synchronous rounds, and at most T of them can fail. You start with the same input complex, because that just represents the input configurations. But you can see that as the computation evolves, you look at one round, some holes start to be created. You look at two rounds, and even more holes, until at two rounds, the complex is completely disconnected. And this is the moment where the three processes can solve consensus, actually, because now they can map the initial input complex, which is connected, into something disconnected. So in terms of topological language, it's one connected, but and eventually zero. It's completely disconnected. And in general, we know that this is deeply related to many concepts in algebraic topology, but just let me jump to the conclusions. So this whole story started in the 70s, when from Lamport's writings, why did it started all this in the 70s? Because it became clear that computers were going to fly commercial aircraft. And then the NSA in the USA began actually to put a lot of money into funding research to figure out how to make this thing reliable enough to be able to fly an airplane. And actually, this is actually the reason to one of these projects, the SIFT project that I was citing. And then Lamport says, over the years, I often wonder whether the people actually building these airplanes know about the results of Byzantine fault tolerance and so on. And he says, by the late 80s and 90s, the people at Boeing were working on military aircrafts and on the space station, and the people at McDonnell Douglas did not understand the problem. So I wonder if our great theoretical understanding is still not very known today, that they put only one sensor in the airplane. So we have come anyway a long way since the time that in the 70s that people were building distributed systems that they could not even say exactly what was the problem being solved, and much less what kind of failures were being tolerated. And the final conclusion is that sequential computing is very different from distributed computing. Distributed computing is really not about Turing machines. Actually, all the models that we have been talking about, they assume that the machine that is being run in each specific node of the network is not even a Turing machine, could have an infinite number of states. That means that even if you have a machine that is hyper-Turing machine computable, you still cannot solve consensus, you still cannot solve coordination. It's not, the limitations do not come from Turing machine issues, but from a completely perpendicular concern, which is topological stretchings and modifications. So topological distributed computing is about, is, you could say that is the science of perspectives. And it's so interesting because perspectives actually from a different people have perspective from a situation, but as they talk to each other, their perspective evolve, they change. But what we have seen is that they can evolve in a very complicated ways, which depends on the way they talk to each other and on the environment. In our book, we collect the basic things, the basic techniques and theory about this that shows that computability, actually distributed computability, is determined by how well the topology is preserved, and the topological, the complexity in terms of time is determined by how fast you can subdivide an input complex. But many, of course, many other things remain to be done, especially topological techniques are needed to analyze better systems that are very dynamic, where the number of processes change, where, of course, the algorithm is probabilistic as related to blockchain techniques. And we could see that the evolution of this area has started with objects, as in the museum, then distributed system is objects interacting with each other, and maybe you could think of blockchains as distributed systems interacting with each other and with the many interesting issues of blockchains.
Thank you very much.